Good morning. First-year college persistence hovers around 70%, with so many who would like to attend college and can't. Is there a role for the private sector to help students work and still go to school? Contributing editor Neil Milner looks at one collaboration. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Well, after college, family size is growing among educated women, according to a new study. Sociologist Patricia Steinhoff considers the Hawaii context.
And the structures we build say a lot about us. The historic Hawaii Foundation works to keep that heritage alive. Executive Director Kirsten Faulkner outlines the criteria for a National Heritage Site. And George and Martha can be quite a handful when they get a couple of drinks in them. Kauai Community Players Director Cass Foster brings Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to the stage.
Those conversations and a few more as the conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and right across the table from me, it's you, Chris Vandercook. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, I used to think a day would come when everybody would be able to go to college.
Well, wasn't that what everyone was being told? You must go to college.
Back in the Great Society days, that was the dream.
And for a lot of people, it's still the dream, but being able to fulfill it is a whole matter entirely different. Now, whether you remember your college years or maybe you're facing them with a kid, you know, many students and families often can't pay or continue to pay for college. According to the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, of all students who started college in the fall of 2013, about 70% returned to college at any U.S. institution in the fall of 2014. Now, many who don't return try to find employment. Just talk to your favorite barista. Now, one employer you probably know is collaborating to help employees who want to start or want to go back to college. Contributing editor Neil Milner had a look at the program, and today we pick up our Longview conversation about staying in college, and it's not about graduation. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we've had lots of conversations about the vast differences in graduation rates among equally qualified students who come from relatively well-off or poor families. But this program that you had a look at that's being talked about a lot now, certainly in the Atlantic, it has really doesn't discriminate. It's if you want to be in college and you're working part-time, they're going to help you. Who's the they?
The they is, Starbucks initiated it. This is based on Amanda Ripley's article in the recent Atlantic called How to Graduate from Starbucks. Starbucks initiated this and worked out a collaboration with Arizona State University, which is one of the biggest and most prominent online university programs in the country. They worked out this deal where if you work at Starbucks for at least 20 hours a week, you're eligible for this. Those who've completed 2 years of college credits already get the rest of college for free. You go to Arizona State online for free. You can even march through the graduation. Those who have had less than 2 years or no college working at Starbucks get about a 22% discount on tuition until they finish the 2 years, at which time they get the money reimbursed and can get the last 2 years for free. So it's really any pretty regular employee barista at Starbucks has a chance here to go to college.
But first, making sure that if you're just starting, that you're going to get a little skin in the game, too, and take that hard-earned money and stick it back into your education.
That's right. And this is really geared. That the most interesting thing about it is not that it's a highly visible company like Starbucks, although that's pretty interesting that they would do that, because it's kind of an indirect investment. And they may lose employees, and they're fine with that as they improve and move on to other kind of jobs. This program is geared toward what's the most serious problem about people going to college, and that is finishing, not getting in. And as you say, we've talked about that before. What this program does that most universities and colleges don't do is give the students very much individual attention. Now, remember, these are online classes, and this is really addressed to the fact that one of the reasons that it's so hard to finish college, it's not just the money, and we've talked about this before. college is a bewildering experience to a lot of folks, especially folks who are coming from families who are not all that well off. They don't have any kind of experience around universities. They don't have any kind of background for them. And they tend, even if they're very good students, they tend to react to doing badly on one or two things in a very significant way and start to drop out. So some schools have experimented with what's really individualized attention, and that's what this program does. These people get calls all the time from academic advisors, reminding them to do things, just checking in with them. This is, by the way, a private academic advising firm. So what you get here is the central thing that is really important about this program, besides giving a chance for people to go for free to college, is that it tries to overcome all these things that collectively get people to drop out. As Ripley says, colleges are not made to get you to graduate. They're made to get you to enroll. And this is an attempt to move toward getting you into graduation and getting that bachelor's degree, which has become such an important marker of success in the United States.
Neil, you say that, you know, Starbucks initiated this conversation and program. Was this done before the, you know, their campaign for race discussions, or is this a reaction to it?
I don't know. Yeah, the campaign for race discussion certainly came out about the same time publicly, but I'm pretty sure that this started earlier. And this is this involved a long-term discussion collaboration with a very progressive president of Arizona State University who shares some of the same ideas that Schultz has. This is Howard Schultz, the president or CEO of Starbucks, is a pretty socially aware, socially conscious person and wants to do two things, really. He wants to manifest that in his businesses and show that you can make profits and do that. And he also wants to show that there's a whole lot of private initiatives that you can do. This is not a government program by any means. There's some links to some ideas that government programs have. So that's the thing. This has gotten far better publicity than the racism one, which always seemed a little bit contrived and cumbersome.
But this is also addressing a real issue that goes across society, period. As you look at this program, does this become a model for other companies? And do you have any knowledge of any other companies who are looking at doing something similar?
I don't have any knowledge at this time. One of the things that to remember is that Starbucks is really an exceptional workforce in some ways. It doesn't surprise me that that the Starbucks people, the baristas, are really folks who have gone to college for a while, want to go. If you ever talk to any of them, that seems to be the case. But Starbucks people are, it's hard to get a job as a barista. They only take about 4%. What's different about this program that we always have to remember in regard to how it affects the economy generally and how applicable it is generally is that the Starbucks workers are employed. If you work full-time, you make about $40,000 a year. This does not get at that kind of hardcore, unemployed high school graduate who's never been able to find the kind of decent working class job that his or her father or mother had in the past. So this doesn't really address itself to people who are unemployed or marginally employed, but it does address itself in other things. I don't know if other companies may try it. As I say, Starbucks is kind of an exceptional company, but what they're trying to do here is kind of in the wind. There's a lot of talk about universities becoming more accessible once you're in, doing things that help students in ways that those of us who went to college earlier never had. And the movement toward making college cheaper or even free. I remember President Obama and some other states have tried to move in the direction of free community college. So it's in the wind. I'm not so sure that it's going to be a general program that lots of companies will adopt, but I think it has some potential. As long as you remember it's dealing with people who are employed and want to move up, get that bachelor's degree, which makes a huge difference in the economy.
All right, Neil, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but I know we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for this one.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too. Neil Milner is our contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Later in the show, making sure that memories of the past always have a home. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we've got historic preservation on our minds. We'll talk with Kirsten Faulkner of the Historic Hawaii Foundation in just a couple of minutes. And that also got us thinking about the latest Hawaii site to be designated as a national monument just a few months ago. In February, President Obama designated the site of a Second World War internment camp on Oahu as a national monument. It was the longest operating and largest internment and prisoner camp of war camp in the islands, a 160-acre site on West Oahu that held over 300 detainees and nearly 4,000 prisoners of war. Most were second-generation Japanese-Americans, but some German and Italian permanent residents were also detained there. Today, we're looking for the name of this notorious facility. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. There's an HPR T-shirt waiting for you if you're the first to get it right.
Good morning. I'm Kurt Tsui from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Homes carry a lot of history inside them, and who knows what stories are lost forever when they're torn down. The work of historic preservationists is aimed at keeping more than bricks and mortar alive, and the Historic Hawaii Foundation wants people who live in or know of a historic structure to be able to nominate a site to the Hawaii and National Registers of Historic Places. To that end, the foundation is offering a series of public workshops, and Kirsten Faulkner, Executive Director, is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Kirsten.
Good morning, Chris.
I guess this is really a matter of having people understand what the criteria are for having a building be a National Historic Site, yeah?
That's right. Both the state and the national governments keep lists of properties that tell the history and the stories of all of our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And those registers of historic places go through a nomination process that really outlines what makes them historically significant. Is it the design? Is it the artistic features? Is it someone who lived or worked or was associated with it? Is it part of an event or a major part of our history? So doing the documentation to explain all of that is a really important part of documenting and remembering what happened and where and why.
Well, for the historian to be able to go to, Kauaihao Church or the Appomattox Courthouse, any place that has had an event take place in it, I mean, that historians don't need it explained to them why that's important. Does the public understand, do you think?
I think that when living memory is associated with a particular place, we take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
We know what happened because we lived through it. But as generations proceed and that living memory fades and eventually goes away, future generations won't have that same immediacy. They don't have that same knowledge. So knowing what happened is needs to be documented in some way. Often it's oral history, but again, memories fade and the stories aren't always told, or they may not be told accurately as well. So knowing the stories and writing them down and doing it in a very methodical and disciplined way can help keep that alive. I think about World War II and how important it was at Pearl Harbor and throughout Hawaii. We just heard the quiz that related to one aspect of that.
Yeah.
And part of that is there are many, those generations are gone. World War One is gone. So how do we know what happened? Well, we go back to those sites and we relive those stories and we share that across the generations.
When you're in the physical setting of a historic event, and yeah, I am thinking about that internment camp here on Oahu, to actually go there and imagine all these people interned there, being in that physical space is going to give you a very different understanding of the history than anything else, don't you think?
I think experiencing a place with all of our senses is much more powerful than just reading about it or experiencing it through photos or a book or, you know, an online sort of experience, a virtual experience. When we stand in a dry and dusty gulch and are not able to see out, and you can feel the heat and you can feel the mosquitoes and you can imagine what it was like with hundreds and thousands of people there, mm-hmm. that's a very different empathy and understanding than just reading about it. So the places themselves have power. The places themselves are educational, they're inspirational, and they can really allow us to learn from the past and apply it to our contemporary lives.
Sure, a POW camp, an internment camp, is an abstraction. But when you stand in a hot, dusty place, as you described, and then say to yourself, okay, you can't leave, you know, as a visitor, you can just get up and go. But if you put yourself in that place of somebody who is stuck there, yeah, that's going to make you feel different than anything else.
A big part of historic preservation is trying to foster understanding and communication. And some of that is across generations, but much of it is just across different people's experiences. And it doesn't always have to be the big national and international events like a war or an internment camp. Much of it can just be everyday life. You know, we experience the places where we went shopping or went to school or interacted with our neighbors or interacted with our friends and family. And that becomes a touchstone of a community. It becomes a touchstone of our identity and our culture. So having the parks, having the main streets, having the neighborhoods helps with that common understanding and cohesiveness of a community.
And that also argues, Kirsten, that it isn't just the very old that needs to be preserved. In fact, we probably need to be thinking about structures that we're creating now and as emblematic of our current lives and how future generations are going to look back on them the same way, huh?
It's very interesting. We have debates, you know, within our own communities about, well, what is historic and even what is old. And often it's the generation before the current generation, right? So for people in their 20s, it's really the 70s that's historic.
Yeah.
People in their 30s, it's the 60s. People in their 40s, it's the 50s. So, you know, the bar is always moving because we're always creating more history.
Yeah.
And as new generations come on, what they remember nostalgically or what they experienced in their youth becomes their touchstone, their benchmark.
It's I think difficult for a lot of people to think that, you know, what we're going to do today will someday be considered historic, right? We seem to have a completely different compartment in our minds for the here and now.
Which is one reason why having a methodical and disciplined historic preservation program becomes important.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it's very immediate, we don't have that distance and that objectivity that comes with time. So usually the benchmark is about 50 years. Things can be historic before they're 50 years old, but often we need that distance to be able to evaluate it more objectively. Because you're right, otherwise it's just too close to us. We can't see it with that kind of objective view.
This is going to be very, things that even don't seem that interesting to us day to day will be fascinating to somebody at some point, yeah?
That's especially true, I think, with little details of things we can take for granted. A couple of years ago, Historic Hawaii Foundation did a study on mid-century modern design. So this is post-World War II, 1950s, 1960s design. And one of our researchers is an architectural historian who did a photo essay of details of walk-up apartments in Makiki, which is the most obscure detail you would ever think about. But this photo exhibit showed the signage and the use of lava rock and the use of railings in a very detailed way. It was absolutely lovely.
I remember that.
It was a new way to look at those buildings.
Yeah, I remember that, Kirsten. It was surprisingly fascinating. Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Kirsten Faulkner is the Executive Director of the Historic Hawaii Foundation, and her next Hawaii and National Register of Historic Places nomination workshop will be in Wailuku, Maui, this Friday from 9 to noon at the J. Walter Cameron Center. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Beth Kobliner, people have questions about college. Do you have answers?
I hope so. I think that there's a lot people can do to prepare themselves, whether they're entering college or they're leaving with debt and need to pay it back.
Kobliner on College, that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio thanks our family of contributors, volunteers, and community partners, including Ho'omanana Mele, Royal Hawaiian Center, and Hawaii Polo Club for your participation and your generous support during Challenge 2015.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Bank of Hawaii Family Sunday, Hot Wheels, featuring two-wheeled activities in celebration of National Bike Month, 11 a.m. this Sunday, honolulumuseum.org.
Maybe you've asked this question too. Where has all the money gone for rail? Civil Beat has been reviewing what's in the checkbook for the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transit. Continuing its periodic series Off Track, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has more of those details in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I know you've been going through a lot of paperwork. How much of their checkbook did you actually get to peer into?
Well, Nick Groomey and Bob Porterfield filed a public records request. And so what they got back was expenses between 2007 up until March of this year. And what they found out, get this, 4,800 checks have been issued so far, 4,800 checks. And that totals more than $1.4 billion. That's about one-fourth of the total cost of the rail project, right? $6 billion and counting, I guess we should say. So there is information about what the big prime contractors are making, folks like Kiewit and Ansaldo and Parsons Brinkerhoff and so forth, money going for consultants and lawyers. The problem is there's not a lot of detail, very little at all actually, about the subcontractors, all those other people that are being hired by these companies to help build the rail project. And that's frustrating because you would think, remember, this is a public works project. Remember that we're paying for this. This is taxpayer dollars. You'd think we'd be able to have right down to the penny knowing exactly where that money is going. But that's not the case.
But yet there are those checks for things like colored paper and cookies and, you know, other things that seem that they are down to the penny. Down to that 37 cents and $12.57 for the cookies served at a public hearing. Those things are there, but not a breakdown of what those subcontractors are being
right.
paid for.
And the reason is because HART has to report its expenses for salaries and expenses through the city, right? So the city's budget department. So that's why we do know that $12 was spent on cookies at a public hearing, or $62. Yes, down to the penny, right? And then $62, like for federal transit officials. But again, that's a different standard that's required of HART for its salaries and expenses. They say that they don't have to report the expenses of subcontractors. But in fact, Bob and Nick have looked at federal regulations, and we believe that there is an argument that, in fact, they could find out what that where that money is going and report that to the public. But that's something that we've reported on previously. It's frustrating that we can know that there's $12.57 for cookies, but not how much is going to, say, a PR firm, which certainly is drawing in millions of dollars. A lot of money spent on public relations.
Well, I mean, the idea that they could do it if they wanted to do
right.
it, because clearly they're breaking down other things that we've just talked about, but they don't feel that they have to do it. And that also means that, you know, maybe we're going to continue not to know what some of those other pieces are. How strong are the, are those federal regulations that you think that you've looked at that might compel them to do that?
Well, Hart doesn't seem to feel that they have to oblige by that. But folks like Ernie Martin, the council chair, would like to have an audit. He feels that a lot of folks are frustrated, that, that there's it's widespread frustration about this lack of financial detail and questionable government oversight. So we'll see whether the county cracks down on that. One other thing, David Ige, the governor, is still reviewing that rail tax extension, and the governor has previously expressed his own frustration about where has all the money gone for rail and why are you asking taxpayers for more money?
All right. Well, the question we're all going to continue to ask until we get some answers, perhaps. Thanks for a little bit more this morning. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line, and you've got a summer course in entrepreneurship, yeah?
Well, we've got a couple of things on the lineup today. I mean, we have a we had Beeling Chua come on and Alice Lee talk about the class that they're going to be doing in the summer session up at Scheidler for entrepreneurs. So that'll be kind of interesting because they got it. They got a guy coming in from Hong Kong that's got some pretty high-powered connections in the sort of investor community. So that's going to be sort of, I think, an interesting course to take if you're a startup or an entrepreneur. The main lineup that we have on the show today is that we're going to be talking to a bunch of folks about the project called Fahrenheit 73.
That's a great one, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it really is. And I know you guys covered it a bit, and we got Linda Chu Takayama, who's part of Hawaii 3Rs, and she's coming on. We got a student that came in from Mauna Loa, and we have Tiffany Quezada from she's one of the mentors for the Center for Tomorrow's Leaders. So we basically kind of talk around how did these students come up with this really sort of innovative idea, and I think it's gotten a lot of people interested because according to Linda, who basically kind of vets a lot of these projects that go into the DOE, she said this is the first time a project has been implemented that were student-suggested or student-driven.
And it's important, too, you can tell.
That's
Thanks
right.
so much, Bert. That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mattson. For more than two decades, a dedicated sponsor of the softball throw at the Special Olympics of Hawaii's Summer Games. Mattson.com/foundation.
Not that long ago, the higher a woman's level of education, the higher were her chances of being childless. But that trend has been reversing over the last 20 years. A new analysis of census data by the Pew Research Center shows that among women with an MD or a PhD, 35% were childless in 1994. Today, it's 20%. The kicker is that not only are highly educated women more likely to have children, they are having more of them. We called Patricia Steinhoff, chair of the UH Manoa Sociology Department, to get her take on the data and its implications for Hawaii. She joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
As you look at this study, well, compilation of data from the census, is there anything in here that seems to be counterintuitive to all the information that you've seen from the 70s and the 80s?
No, I think it makes good sense. And I'm most impressed that the Pew study not only points to the change in the data, but their explanation of it is absolutely on the mark. They understand that more highly educated women have been flowing into the workplace in career-type jobs, and they have delayed child-rearing so that if you look at earlier age groups, it appears that there are more of them that are childless. But by the time you reach their 40s, which is when you can start to measure completed family size, they've caught up, and they are having children. They are having them later.
They're having them later, but they're also having more of them. It's not just having a child, but it's having several.
Well, not really several. It's having usually two. Slight increase in the number having three, but the dominant number is still the one or two child family.
At this point, when we say women are waiting until later, that also brings up issues of fertility. Are they doing this with help, or are they doing it and we're just seeing numbers of families who are able to have children at a later date?
We don't know from this kind of census data, and that would take much more intensive examination. Certainly, there are more fertility options for women at older ages, and it is much safer for them to be carrying children to term when they're close to 40 or even after 40 than it used to be. So they're more willing to go ahead at a time when 20 or 30 years ago, they might have been counseled not to do so.
In the changes between 1994 and 2014, where so many women were entering the workforce and wondering how they were going to do everything, was there a sense that maybe they were missing out on something by the time they got into their 40s?
By not having children?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that there is a sense that that women have on their bucket list that they want to be mothers. And so more women wanted to have it all. Their aspirations went up. Their education levels went up. They were working at levels that their mothers wouldn't have dreamed of, but they didn't want to give up on other aspects of their lives. So I think that's what we're seeing, is that there was a period when the choice was either be professional or have a family, and many women said, no, I want it all. Of course, there's been a lot of talk in the media recently about women who decide that they can't do it all and drop out of the labor force. But these statistics suggest that the larger trends are quite stable, and that women are able to fulfill both their occupational and their motherhood goals.
For women who are not in college, a lot of women who only finished high school or maybe just started college in those early 20s, we've also been seeing an uptick in single mothers who are doing this by choice. How do you sort of look at that statistic and some of what we're seeing with this that you say seems, perfectly logical to understand that as mm-hmm. women got older, they would choose to be mothers now that they can and they've completed some of their career opportunities? What about the younger women who are just saying, oh, the heck with it, and doing it because they want to have a baby?
Well, a lot of those babies are, in fact, unplanned. They choose to carry the pregnancy to term, but they did not. The pregnancy itself was accidental. The patterns for less educated women and more educated women have been different for a very long time. And for young women who do not see a great future in work life, choosing to have a child at an early age is for them a way of establishing identity and of fulfilling what for them are the most important goals. So it's not surprising that you see those. Some of the difference is that 50 years ago, they might have been forced into a shotgun marriage that was either unhappy or soon dissolved, and nowadays they are more likely to just remain single and have the child on their own.
At this point, as you look at these numbers and this study or the analysis from mm-hmm. Pew in terms of what we see in Hawaii, where we know how expensive it is
yeah.
to have one child, let alone two or more, and try to put that into some perspective. How do you assess that?
Okay. We can't find exactly comparable figures because the Pew data were massaged by demographers to get to the numbers that they came up with. But from the general patterns from recent statistics for Hawaii, we have slightly higher educational levels than the U.S. as a whole. The U.S. is 28.2% with a bachelor's degree. Hawaii as a state is 29.4. Honolulu is 31.8, as you would expect. The higher education concentrates in the big city. We have about the same age at first marriage in Hawaii the U.S. as a whole. But we have a higher number of people in the household. In the U.S. as a whole, it's 2.1. In the state, it's 2.9. It's Honolulu, it's 3.0. And we have a lower number of children living in households with a single parent. It's 35% in the U.S. as a whole and 31% in Hawaii. That suggests that, as we've known for a long time, families are relatively stable in Hawaii. There are more multi-generational families. There are more families around to help with child care and to make sure that children are nurtured properly. Remember, we are also talking about women who have high education. The median household income in Hawaii, although of course it doesn't go as far, but it is substantially higher in Honolulu than in the U.S. as a whole. 50,000 for the U.S., 62,000 for Hawaii, 65,000 for Honolulu. The women that the Pew study is talking about have professional-level jobs, so they are the people in the current situation who are more able than the average person to handle the expenses of raising children, whether it's one or two.
So basically, when it comes to Hawaii, perhaps we were leading a trend that we didn't know that we were leading until we saw a lot of this research material that came from Pew. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Patricia Steinhoff is the chair of the sociology department at UH Manoa, although she's known primarily as a Japan specialist. During the 1970s and early 80s, she did extensive work on pregnancy, abortion, and birth control in Hawaii and co-authored the book Abortion Politics, The Hawaii Experience with Milton Diamond. The link to the Pew Research Center analysis is on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we tested your memory about Hawaii's latest national monument, a 160-acre Oahu site that's home to some dark memories. It was a Second World War internment site built in response to President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, issued in February 1942. Under the terms of the order, U.S. citizens with as little as 1/16th Japanese blood could be detained without due process of law. During that conflict, some 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry were detained in War Relocation Authority camps and Department of Justice internment camps. Over 3,000 of those detained were Hawaii residents of Japanese ancestry. We asked you to name the camp, and as Senator Mazie Hirono said, these stories of those detained at Honouliuli and internment sites like it across the country are sobering reminders of how even leaders of the greatest nation on earth can succumb to fear and mistrust and perpetuate great injustice.
And David Pettinger from IAEA called us with the right answer, so you will be receiving a T-shirt, David. And thanks also to Rayana, who called us from Salt Lake. She said that she remembers going by Honouliuli when she was growing up. Thanks very much for your calls. It's now 8:47. You got the answer to today's quiz, but there'll be another quiz coming tomorrow. And if you'd like to send us one, you can do that too. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Joanne Chang from Boston's Flower Bakery and Myers & Chang. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm tired. It's late. I've been drinking since 9 o'clock. My wife's been vomiting. There's a lot of screaming going on around here. And you're testy. Well, don't worry about it. Anybody who comes here ends up getting testy. It's expected. Don't be upset.
I'm not upset.
You're testy. Yes. Oh, I wanted to set you straight about something.
It's fun to follow the progress of a theatrical production from casting to performance. That's what we set out to do when we talked with director Cass Foster several months ago about his Kauai Community Players production of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. There's some powerful emotions going on in this play, and there's a lot to keep in balance, a challenge for director and actors alike. The show's running now, and we're going to check in with Cass to see how his best-laid plans work out. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris, and aloha from the beautiful Garden Isle of Kauai.
Yeah, I'm amazed at how long ago that was that we talked, because you've been working on this production for, what, 5-6 months now?
That's correct. We have. It's been quite a process, especially for the actors who are not accustomed to working more than a couple of months to rehearse a show.
Well, there's a lot that has to be really refined about this show, I would think, because, you know, if you go too far in one direction, it's just all bitterness. But as we just heard from that little excerpt there's a lot of comedy in this show, isn't there?
Oh, I tell you, that was probably the most rewarding experience to our opening weekend, because my actors, they're dealing with a director, with one person for 4 or 5 months, constantly working with them, constantly criticizing them, constantly guiding them.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we've had two full houses this weekend, and the laughter was so beyond their imagination. They had no idea how funny they are.
That's perfect, because, and actors shouldn't act as if they're supposed to be funny, right?
That's correct. The humor is, from the audience's perspective, when the actors don't find their situation humorous. That's what makes it funny.
Yeah, people are being ridiculous. They never know they're being ridiculous, right?
Yeah, the stage is just like real life.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you don't want the show to go too far in any one of its many directions it can go, right? You need to. There's so much to keep in balance, I would think.
Well, that's exactly, you're touching on why we've been in rehearsal for so long.
Yeah.
It would be really easy to play it either with, like you say, with bitterness or with anger. And there are so many really rich layers. I mean, it's an absolutely brilliant script.
Yeah.
And part of my work is to find the diversity, to find a combination of absurdity, drama, and humor. And I dare say I think we found it.
Well, you have the dynamic, you know, there's all kinds of things just contained within the dynamic of an older couple, a younger couple, established academics versus aspiring academics. The whole, you know, the politics of academe come in, or the sort of sexual politics, human politics. Lots of cross currents, yeah?
Yeah, especially when in the case of George and Martha are the primary couple in this script, especially when you have such a dysfunctional relationship, such a weighty marriage, where she uses his, if you will, his lack of success, you might say, in academia against him, and plays with that with this new young couple coming in to, you know, meet some faculty on the college campus and schmooze with the daughter of the college president. And boy, are they in for some surprises.
Yeah, no kidding. But you also have, among the things that George and Martha resent about the younger couple is just the very fact of their youth, right?
That's exactly right. And they play that game with each other consistently through the show, pointing out how George is 6 years younger than Martha, and she sarcastically says, "And I don't really care," you know. It's I love your lead in with that scene between Nick and George, how George plies him and plies him endlessly with alcohol, with a very sort of again dysfunctional relationship, and how he uses it to get this young faculty member off his game.
Well, yeah, and I would think that for actors in a production like this, you have to, you know, in the course of the time on stage, you're getting drunk, right? You're getting progressively more impaired and going through the various stages of drinking too much, you know, the giddiness.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. And that's been one of the huge challenges putting this show together, helping my actors explore how this inebriation is affecting them throughout this this 2.5 hours plus of performance.
Sort of like how okay, by now I've had two drinks, so I'm this hammered, and by the next scene I'm going to have had another, and so that really gets a progressive inebriation, right?
And your insights are right on, and that was one of my first assignments when we started the rehearsal process. They need to know in each scene, in each act, how many drinks they've consumed. And that's you know, it sounds kind of an odd way to approach a script, but it has such a profound impact on how they relate to each other and their state of mind, that the alcohol is a huge component in this script.
Yeah, and you really see all the, you know, the sentimental stage, the belligerent stage, the giddy stage, all the little stages of drunkenness are right there for you to see, huh?
Yeah, and probably every emotional quality of a human relationship is brought out in this play, from the good to the ridiculous to the very ugly. And so part of their work is to explore that and to make it realistic, to make it believable, to not get caught up in the fact that this is somewhat of an absurdist piece, that we don't play the absurdity, we play it sincerely. And then the audience, of course, is what sees this as somewhat absurd.
And we might even feel that our lives have a little touch of absurdity, too. Cass,
oh, definitely.
Thanks very much for talking with us. It's good to talk to you again.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Chris. Thanks again for your coverage. We've got two more weekends, and we look forward to rousing, laughing audiences.
I imagine. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Cass Foster is the director of the Kauai Community Players production of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which runs until May 24th at Lihue's Puhi Theatrical Warehouse. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
On the next Radiolab,
we found
these, like, fields.
A whole hilltop. Fields just covered in this.
It was so eerie. It was...
I haven't seen anything like that before.
Yellow.
Yellow.
Fluffy stuff.
Hidden worlds.
Whoa, what's that? And here we are still on Earth. We're not in outer space. We're not on the moon. Here we are on Earth.
Saturday morning at 10.
Here we are on Earth, yes. I think we also got sucked into
where
that one.
Yeah.
There was this tremendous quiet as we were all listening
That's
to
right.
that promo.
We're just contemplating our place in the universe, I think is what it was.
Yeah, well, for the place in the universe that a lot of young people may be contemplating, our first conversation this morning with Neil Milner about the program that's a collaboration between Arizona State University Online and Starbucks seems to be just, you know, tailor-made for somebody who is trying to find his or her way.
Some way has got to be found to get more people in college without the backbreaking costs that they're facing now. And, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that whole Great Society Lyndon Johnson dream, that a president who himself went to a state teachers college once thought that everybody would be able to go to college.
And while it's true that not everybody should go to college, not all people want to go to college, at least being able to find some conduit for someone who may be working for Starbucks as a barista and who wants more, well, maybe they got a shot at it now.
Let's hope so.
Well, it's almost 9 o'clock and we got to go. But coming up tomorrow, another slice of life in Hawaii through the eyes of Neil Conan.
And a walking tour of Honolulu's senior side back in the war years.
Again, you can get to us anytime you like on our talk back line at 808-792-8217. We're on social media. You can find us all over the place. And you can also send us an email if you'd like to do that at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive, along with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderfield.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you back here tomorrow morning for more of the conversation.